You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of September 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Guy Delaunay, and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, exit polls suggest that key Merkel ally Horst Seehofer will be returned as the leader of Bavaria. Quentin Peel, the Berlin bureau chief for the Financial Times, will join us to discuss what that may mean for next weekend's federal election in Germany.
And James Boyes from King's College London will join us in the studio to discuss today's news agenda. What do you have for us, James?
Well, this morning, guys, we're looking at talks with Tehran, a devastating attack on Obama's foreign policy. And as autumn begins here in London, it really is the end of summers.
More from James coming right up. Plus, our culture team channel the spirit of Ireland and speak to artist Fiona Hallinan about her audio project Heterodyne.
I was driving and it was really, really misty, and I was listening to that piece of music, and this deer ran in front of the car at a certain moment, and it just made this sort of coincidental feeling happen. And I think it's like a sort of certain way of reading the world in a way. It's quite magical.
All that, plus we'll check in with our man in Auckland, review the Turkish front pages and play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Bonnie Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. An attempt to pull the shipwrecked Costa Concordia upright is underway off the coast of Italy. Overnight storms delayed the start of the operation by around 2 hours. 32 people died when the cruise ship hit rocks off the Tuscan island of Giglio in January last year. It's been lying on its side ever since, and engineers have never tried to move such a huge ship so close to land. Franco Porcellacchia, vice president of Carnival Corporation, says he's confident everything possible has been done to reduce the environmental impact of the salvage operation.
We are trying to minimize the impact. We are sure that it will be kept to the minimum. And also we have a number of actions to contain the eventual debris, and we believe that it will be effective, as it has been since we started.
The French President François Hollande says the Russian-American agreement on Syria's chemical weapons is an important step towards the much greater goal of finding a political solution to the civil war. In a TV address, he said a vote on a new UN Security Council resolution could be agreed this week. But he also said the military option must remain in place or there'd be no pressure to put on Syria. The US Vice President Joe Biden says Russia's President Vladimir Putin was acting out of naked self-interest when he floated the proposal for Syria to hand its chemical weapons over to international control. But speaking in Iowa, Mr. Biden said the US remains firmly committed to making the plan work.
We're going to the United Nations with a resolution this week that will in fact call on the United Nations and the world to put pressure on Syria to have the confiscation and destruction of all those weapons.
At least 21 people have been killed in Mexico after a hurricane and a tropical storm converged on the country. Hurricane Ingrid is expected to arrive on the east coast on Monday. Winds of 75 miles an hour have already caused severe damage in Veracruz and Tamaulipas states. Tropical storm Manuel has already hit the west coast, bringing almost half the average monthly rainfall in just 3 days. Thousands of people have been forced to leave their homes, and Independence Day celebrations were called off in many towns. Officials in Colorado are warning that the number of people killed by severe flooding could rise after it was confirmed that a second person was missing, presumed dead, in addition to 4 deaths previously verified. An 80-year-old woman has been at home with an injury when the floods destroyed the building. Previously, authorities had confirmed that a 60-year-old woman was missing, presumed dead, after witnesses said they saw her mountain home being swept away. Hundreds of people are still unaccounted for, but officials say most of them are listed as missing because they don't yet have working telephone services. Larimer County Sheriff Justin Smith.
How can we ever recover from this? And I know exactly, inch by inch, mile by mile, community by community, they're taking this stuff back. They're doing it. People are getting those things done out there. And it always takes 24, 48, 72 hours to find out what you need and get those folks in. Those things are coming into the area. They're making the progress.
A fire has broken out on an atomic-powered Russian submarine which was undergoing repairs at a shipyard near Vladivostok. Two firefighting vessels are tackling the blaze, and a ship which monitors radiation levels has been sent to the area as a precaution. Officials say there is no threat of radioactive contamination, as the nuclear reactor on the vessel had been shut down before it arrived in dock. South Korean businessmen and workers have crossed the border into North Korea to reopen the jointly run industrial park which had been suspended in April. Last Wednesday, North and South Korea agreed to reopen Kaesong Industrial Park from today on a trial basis. South Korea's Unification Ministry, which is responsible for handling inter-Korean relations for the South, said 820 people and 556 vehicles left the transit office at the border for Kaesong. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney Burnham. It's 6 minutes past the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Londres. Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
From London,
London,
Kara.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 14:07 in Jakarta, 10:07 in Beirut, and 08:07 here in London at Midori House, where you're listening to Midori House. Time to set the day's news agenda, and here to do it is Dr. James Boyes, Senior Visiting Fellow at King's College London. Morning, James.
Good morning.
Now, I'm enjoying the headline in The Guardian, which sounds terribly touchy-feely. Iran's Rouhani may meet Obama at UN after American President reaches out.
Yes, it's nice actually to come on and be able to talk about something that's really quite positive, because obviously with the trying to set an agenda, there's so much negativity out there. So it's nice actually to be able to read something in The Guardian which is actually quite positive. And it looks like it's possible. But for the first time since 1977, an American president might be meeting an important member of the Iranian government, for example. The last time that happened, the Shah was in charge. He's obviously no longer around. But this idea now that the new Iranian president might well be meeting the president of the United States, albeit in what would no doubt be a rather innocuous meeting, perhaps, shall we say, at the United Nations, and possibly as early as next week, is a really positive development, I think.
Now, so far, it's only been letters, though, that have been exchanged. Do we know...
And tweets as well, let's not forget.
Do we know the content of the letters at all?
There is a certain vagueness to this point, and I think that both sides are trying to be a little bit careful, but I think the fact that there's a degree of public diplomacy which is coming out, and I was joking about the tweeting element, but the fact that it would appear that the Iranians have taken to the Twitter sphere and have approached the British and the Americans and almost taken the West by surprise with regard to this is quite remarkable, I think. We don't necessarily think of, and maybe it's an arrogance from the West, of the Iranians being high up on Twitter and et cetera. But the fact that they've come out and they've tapped up William Hague on Twitter, I think is a remarable story.
Well, and they've all just, all the leadership have just opened Facebook accounts too, haven't they? That's extraordinary.
Yeah, they've just embraced Facebook as everybody else has moved away for it to LinkedIn and Twitter maybe. But it's remarkable, and it's hopefully an optimistic sign of progress in that country. A lot of people were talking about, you know, the reform that this new leader might be able to bring in. And that, of course, was tempered by the recognition that, of course, you know, the mullahs still obviously remain in charge there. But hopefully we can see that all-famous green shoots of prospect and development coming through here.
It does seem extraordinary that it's been 36 years since the leaders of the two countries met. I mean, Iran, a significant regional player, even if they had been at daggers drawn over these years. It's amazing there hasn't been that high-level contact.
It is, but if you think about it, if you go back to what it was that brought about the end of that sort of situation, it was obviously no small matter for the Americans when, you know, you see the storming of their embassy. I mean, fundamentally, the revolution that brought Khomeini to power brought down an American president.
But let's not forget the revolution which brought the Shah to power as well.
That's very, very true. But, you know, since we're talking about what caused the breakdown in US-Iranian relations, relationships. You know, the idea that you have a movement which brings down the administration of Jimmy Carter, brings to power Ronald Reagan, someone who was going to take a very hard line with regard to this. So you see 12 years of Republican Party rule. Bill Clinton really didn't have any great interest in getting involved in Iran at that point, although there were feelers put out, certainly in the second term, and Madeleine Albright, I know, was very optimistic, but that didn't come to pass. And I think overtures were destroyed by Clinton's impeachment in the second term, to be frank. Then you have 9/11 and all the ramifications thereof. So don't forget, when Obama came to power, he talked about sitting down, you know, as long as Iran, you know, unclenched its iron fist. So maybe in his second term, we're going to see something positive coming out of this administration at last.
I mean, we have seen before with Rafsanjani when he was president, it looked like there might be some sort of rapprochement then. Is it going to be more concrete? What's the difference between that and Rouhani, say?
Well, who knows at this point, to be quite honest. Maybe we are clutching at straws, but the idea that they are talking about potentially having a run-in together, even if it is almost like a Gordon Brown, Barack Obama meeting in a kitchen somewhere, then that may not be such a bad thing and could at least be the beginning of something positive in Obama's foreign policy.
And of course, brought about in part by developments in Syria. And that's the next thing you wanted to have a look at.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I say that, what I wanted to dovetail into was this idea that the Americans are still posturing about taking military action in Syria, which is fascinating, I think, because there's a devastating piece in Time magazine this week by Joe Klein. And I really wanted to highlight it because one of the problems with dealing with Barack Obama is that everything is seen in, without a pun intended, black and white. If you embrace the president, you are therefore loyal and democratic. And if you critique him for any reason, well, that must be because you're a neoconservative. The problem is Joe Klein has phrased this perfectly. Joe Klein is an American author. He wrote the book
Primary Colors
that was out initially anonymously. This is a guy, you know, very, very respected by the American Democratic left. And he's written an absolutely beautiful piece here. And let me just quote it very, very quickly. This has been most closely held American foreign policy making since Nixon and Kissinger. Only there's no Kissinger. Couldn't put it better. There's no emigrants, Greece, to basically say, Mr. President, you're taking the wrong line here.
Alternatively, there's no one to say, let's bomb a country with which we're not at war.
It's true, but the problem is you've got an American president coming to power who's got no foreign policy experience, and he hasn't brought around him any cool heads, any smart people necessarily, who've got a really strong standing in the foreign policy intelligence community to basically say, this is how we really should play it. And when you see the sort of the mess that the Americans have gotten into, just think about it for a second. You've had John Kerry out there talking very bellicose language, and then within, you know, hours almost, the American president is coming back time and time again and refuting what his Secretary of State has been saying. So it's a real mess. And since we talk about Time magazine, one wonders how popular Vladimir Putin might be as Man of the Year this year coming up.
I'm concerned about how this is all being reported. I'm concerned about the level of interest in America, in Russia, and I'm wondering where the Syrian voices are, because Syria has an 80% literacy rate. There are very, very educated people there. Where are the intellectuals? Where are the teachers? Where are the scribes? We're not hearing those voices from Damascus.
No, absolutely, and I think it's one of the great challenges. I think when you've got a country that's in civil war, as it is, it's probably quite difficult to get the voice out, and it's important, therefore, that they are able to find a voice in the West. And as you rightly point out, it's very, very difficult to find that. Again, without wanting to sort of like be seen as Time magazine's man in the studio, if you look at last week's covers around the world, pretty much every cover except the United States had Putin on there on the cover of Time magazine. The US domestic cover had, should we fund college students? And I think it gives you some indication, perhaps, I mean, slightly dovetailing away from your initial question, about the great problem of how stories are presented around the world. And one of the great challenges of finding international news in the United States. I lived there for some time, and if you wanted to find out what was going on in the rest of the world, or even in America, you had to leave America and then look back on it from overseas, effectively. And it's a real challenge, I think.
It is interesting, though, that you were saying that they're in a mess, the United States, one senior figure saying one thing, then another turning the other way. But on the other hand, the bigger mess would be possibly, or a lot of people feel the bigger mess, would be to get involved with military intervention. So isn't this a case of repeating some sort of history like the Cuban Missile Crisis, where a lot of people were calling for one thing, and then Kennedy, and history has judged Kennedy correctly in this, went another way.
There's no doubt about it. I think, however, if you want to draw the parallels with the Cuban Missile Crisis, one of the things that President Kennedy singularly did not do was to paint himself into a corner. One of the great lessons is you always give your opponent and yourself a very, very easy way out of a situation. And I think Obama has done the exact opposite of that. He painted himself into a corner with his famous red line remarks, which he wasn't meant to do, and has spent the last 12 months desperately trying to back away from that, almost denying, in fact, that he said that in Stockholm last week. So I think, with respect, the lessons of the Cuban Missile Crisis have been singularly unlearned by the Obama administration.
James, let's quickly move on briefly to sure. Larry Summers and his withdrawal.
Yeah, absolutely. For the second time now, within the space of a matter of months, really, since Obama's second term began, a key figure that everybody knew was top of the president's list for a senior position within the executive branch of government has been forced to withdraw publicly before they've even been able to be put forward. The first case, of course, was with Susan Rice, who was going to be the president's main person at the State Department. She had to withdraw after the issues to do with Benghazi, for example, before she'd even been nominated. Now we've got Larry Summers, who everybody knew was meant to be Barack Obama's head of the Fed. He has now had to step down again before he's even been put forward, because this idea that he's just too contentious, frankly, and too tied up with the events that occurred 5 years ago and issues to do with what he said at Harvard. So once again, the Obama administration is going to be faced with having a second-tier person in place going into their second term.
It seems extraordinary. This always seems to happen with appointments of American senior administration officials.
I don't know about always, but certainly it's something that the Obama administration has struggled with, this idea of trying to keep the lid upon nominations before they get to Congress. One of the great issues in the United States that's different from here in the United Kingdom, for example, is that you need to sort of have a great reveal, if you will, of an individual. You take them to Congress, you present them, you parade them, and you get them. You get the nomination process done correctly. And if you think about how many times it has to happen with key officials within the American administration, for Supreme Court nominees, for example, the whole idea there that political appointees are far more political than they are here. And the whole package of getting that done and getting it through Congress is a vital element of running the White House. And it's something that clearly this administration has struggled with.
James, thank you very much indeed. That was Dr. James Boyes, Senior Visiting Fellow at King's College, London.
As our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living, begins hitting shelves around the world, so too do our editors take to the road to celebrate the launch of this 408-page survey on how to live well. We're visiting our favourite bookstores and retailers in 15 cities across the globe to meet subscribers, contributors and fans. Join us for a glass of wine, a spot of shopping and a chance to meet the team. To find out where we're headed in September and October, keep an eye on book.monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 8:18 here in London now, with exit polls showing he has nearly 50% of the vote. Horst Seehofer, nicknamed Crazy Horst,
love that,
is expected to be returned as the leader of Bavaria in state elections, which took place yesterday. Bavaria is home to 12.5 million people and such household names as BMW, Siemens and Adidas. It's Germany's richest state and by far the biggest contributor to the federal budget.
Mr. Seehofer's win would boost Angela Merkel's campaign to be re-elected for a third term in next Sunday's national poll. But he's the leader of the conservative Christian Social Union. And if he's going to continue in the coalition, he may be looking for a better deal from the Chancellor's Christian Democratic Union. So what is Crazy Horst's next move? The man who can tell us is Quentin Peel, the Berlin bureau chief for the Financial Times. Welcome, Quentin.
Hi.
Now it's all laptops and lederhosen, nine.
Well, certainly Bavaria's done its thing again. The truth is that, as we all know, all politics is local, and no place is more local in Germany than Bavaria. Really proud of its doing it its own way. And the funny thing about Crazy Horse is, what a silly name. He's about the most uncharismatic politician you can imagine, but he's very Bavarian. And that's what's pulled it through. That and the fact that Bavaria is feeling very comfortable. They had an opinion poll last week which showed that 84% of Bavarians thought the economy was doing well. It's the highest figure they've ever recorded.
Now, one of the biggest issues for the CSU is road tax. And Merkel is saying that the introduction of fees for foreigners to use Bavarian roads would violate EU laws. Is that the case? And is it a big deal breaker for them?
It won't be a big deal breaker because they're going to end up in government. It is an insane suggestion by the Bavarians. It fits exactly what I was saying just now. They do things their way. It entirely conflicts with European law, and there's no way they can. How can you put a tax just on foreign visitors when you don't tax your own people or anybody else like it? So they won't be able to do it, but they'll have a great song and dance about it, and in the end they'll find some sort of compromise.
Will it be an umpire band to go along with the song and dance? That's what we want to know. But I mentioned laptops and lederhosen, and I wasn't being entirely flippant there, because of course it is an area which mixes high tech, big business, famous names with these Bavarian traditions. So will Crazy Horst and Co. be trying to exercise somehow more influence over a Merkel-led coalition, assuming that she gets in?
Well, they may, but they're only a small bit of tail that wags the dog. There's a much bigger story, if you like, in here, rather than just Bavaria. And that's the liberal collapse in Bavaria. And in a way, that's much more worrying for Merkel, that the Liberal Party, which she needs to form a coalition in Berlin, did so badly. And it's worrying in two ways. Either they'll do very badly next Sunday, and she won't be able to form the present coalition again. So she'll have to do a deal with the Social Democrats. And then the CSU, the Bavarians, really won't have much say in the big trading between the two big elephants in the room. The other worry she's got is that actually so many of her own Christian Democrats will go out feeling sorry for the Liberals and give them their second vote, that actually that way she won't get a majority either. So it's quite a cliff-hanging result, and everything's still in the balance for next weekend.
Now, you mentioned the Social Democrats. How damaged have they been by the problems of their leader, Pierre Steenbrück, and his non-verbal communications? I'm talking, of course, about his finger up.
The stinking finger. They were damaged before, and they were just starting to recover. And the question is, will he have stopped that recovery? Actually, the Bavarian result is not a disaster for them. It's not it's not very good. But they did actually pick up a couple of percentage points. They were the only opposition party in Bavaria that actually improved their showing. So they're not doing too badly, but they're miles behind Merkel individually. And I think what we're seeing more and more is that the likely outcome of next week's election is going to be a very uncomfortable grand coalition between the Social Democrats and Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats, which will mean a long and difficult negotiation before we get a government.
I'm rather disappointed that, having talked him up as Crazy Horst, we haven't done anything particularly insane with Mr. Seehofer. What is the craziest thing you could see him doing, Quentin?
Well, having a battle about this idiotic car tax, because it is simply not legally doable, and yet he's made a huge song and dance about it in the election campaign, and it's been very popular. It's the one issue that he mentioned in every beer tent that got a great cheer. Let's bash the tourists, let's bash the foreign visitors. And it really seems a very silly policy. If he makes a big fuss about that, it'll only make life difficult for doing something that in the end he's going to get told by the European Court is illegal.
So there could be more entertainment to come from Crazy Horse. Many thanks, Quentin. Quentin Peel from the Financial Times in Berlin.
Now, it is 8:24 in London and 19:24 in Auckland, where we head now to speak to our man there, Simon Farrell-Green. Welcome to the show, Simon.
Thank you. Good evening.
What do you have for us today?
The big news here is that the New Zealand Labour Party has elected a new leader after a very public primary campaign. It's actually the first New Zealand primary campaign that's ever been run. There was a change of rules in the Labour Party last year, which has involved basically switching from a situation where the caucus elects the leader to one where the wider party does, and they have a new leader by the name of David Cunliffe. And what's interesting about him is he's not hugely well liked by his caucus colleagues, but he is liked by the wider party. So it'll be very interesting to see how he knits together the party behind him.
I see that when he was asked about John Key's leadership style, he said, "I think it sucks and I think it's time to change." Does it suck? I mean, is that the popular view?
I think the tide is turning on John Key. It's an interesting one. He has been, I mean, you know, he was called Teflon John until quite recently because nothing could stick. But I think what's happening is there's a pattern that Key is sort of showing, which is that he tends to make up things on the fly a little bit. That isn't always necessarily, and this is what Cunliffe is referring to, there isn't necessarily a hugely strong policy background to it. It's a very pragmatic style of leadership. So there have been several instances where the government has done things that don't quite necessarily make sense because they think it's expedient to do so. So they circumvented, you know, a very open process around the building of a international convention centre in Auckland, for instance, and came up with a better deal, which put a few noses out of joint. So I think the tide is turning. I think it's pretty strong language to say it sucks.
Now, Labour was last in power 5 years ago, of course, Prime Minister Helen Clark, a long-serving leader in New Zealand. But for those who haven't been keeping an eye on the fortunes of the party since, Simon, where does Labour stand right now in its chances of getting back into power?
That's a really interesting question. At the last election, they polled pretty badly, something like 28% of the vote, given, bearing in mind, we have a proportional representational system here. So they are polling slightly higher than that, maybe 34 or 35%. National, which is the government, are still just below 50%, so they're in a much stronger position. I think depending on which poll you look at, there's a very strong chance that they could be in government next year once they combine with the Greens, or if they were to combine with the Greens in a coalition. So the race is definitely on. But it has been a patchy recovery for them. You know, they've really struggled to get traction themselves as a party, and they've really struggled to, I think, show New Zealanders that National and John Key are not doing the best job that they could. And they've struggled to show themselves as a valid opposition. So Cunliffe's got a big job to do, and he's got about a year to do it.
And how have they affected the economy? I mean, I see, for instance, that house prices are continuing to surge.
I think that's probably one reason why the gloss hasn't come off the party off the government for a long time is the economy here, I think, for most people is in probably a lot better state still than it would be in other parts of the world. Although the house price issue is becoming increasingly difficult, particularly for younger people. You're seeing enormous rates of growth, particularly in Auckland where I live, depending on which system you use to measure prices, they're increasing at anywhere between sort of 12 and 18% year on year, which is just extraordinary, and it doesn't really seem to be slowing down.
How depressing that house prices are as much talked about in New Zealand as they are in the UK. Simon Farrell-Green, many thanks for joining us from New Zealand.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
Ut London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, dette er Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're with Midori House here from Midori House. It's 8:28 in London. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll discover the story behind one of the world's most iconic images. We'll take a look through the Turkish front pages, and we'll catch up with the artist behind a new audio project in Ireland.
I was driving and it was really, really misty, and I was listening to that piece of music, and this deer ran in front of the car at a certain moment, and it just made this sort of coincidental feeling happen. And I think it's like a sort of certain way of reading the world in a way. It's quite magical.
But first, here's our Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Georgina. An attempt to pull the shipwrecked Costa Concordia upright is underway off the coast of Italy. Overnight storms delayed the start of the operation by around 2 hours. The ship's been lying on its side ever since it hit rocks off the Tuscan island of Giglio in January last year. France's President François Hollande says the Russian-American agreement on Syria's chemical weapons is an important step towards the much greater goal of finding a political solution to the civil war. But he also said the military option must remain or there'd be no pressure to put on Syria. At least 21 people have been killed in Mexico after a hurricane and a tropical storm converged on the country. Hurricane Ingrid is expected to arrive on the east coast later today. Tropical storm Manuel has already hit the west coast, bringing almost half the average monthly rainfall in just 3 days. Officials in Colorado are warning that the number of people killed by severe flooding could rise, as it was confirmed that a second person was missing, presumed dead, in addition to 4 deaths previously confirmed. A fire has broken out on an atomic-powered Russian submarine undergoing repairs at a shipyard near Vladivostok. Officials say there's no threat of radioactive contamination as the nuclear reactor on the vessel had been shut down before it arrived in dock. And South Korean businessmen and workers have crossed the border into North Korea to reopen the jointly run Kaesong Industrial Park, which had been suspended in April. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney Burnham. He'll be back at the top of the hour. Now you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin, and Guy Delaunay. Now, imagine an absolutely stunning cinematic drive along a poker straight road from a city suburb through the mountains into wild highlands, a functionless but beautiful place. Well, it exists. It's called the Military Road in Wicklow, Southern Ireland, not far from Dublin. And it's also the site for a new audio project called Heterodyne.
It's the creation of artist Fiona Hallinan. She's commissioned local composers to produce works for the road, a mixture of music and field recordings forming a soundtrack to accompany your journey. 5 scores for Military Road launched in June. The app launches later this week, of course, and there are plans for more projects around the world, as Monocle's Katie Bilboa found out when she invited Fiona into Midori House to find out more for this week's edition of Culture.
It sort of stemmed from this idea that a car is actually an amazing vehicle for listening. So when you drive in the average car, you are often on your own or with a small number of people. You're equipped with this usually pretty good sound system. You're moving along and the front window of your car also acts as a screen. And I like this idea that you could actually turn that screen into a kind of cinematic experience by placing music upon it. I've worked a lot with audio walks. So I had always really been working in this idea of how you could alter subjective experience through sound. And then it kind of naturally transferred onto this idea of, on a mass scale, that you could do this with roads and other sites of infrastructure as well. A lot of the sort of things that people are wary of in how technology is working now is this idea that we're not really experiencing things or we're not really going to places. And so I love this idea that alongside its use of technology, it's also sort of playing with that idea of presentness and bringing people together, even though it's also maybe allowing people individual experience as well.
Because, yeah, I mean, when I think about driving or travel and music, they do sit together in my mind and in my kind of memories growing up.
Yeah.
And I just remember, you know, even when I drove a car, I had a tape player, a cassette tape player in the car, and I'd listen to people's mixtapes. So
yeah.
I think there is, and you just look back at the kind of, I guess, the heritage of road movies, you're coming out of the US with all the great soundtracks, and there is something about movement and travel that transports you in itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I like the idea that composers can look at this in any way that they want to. What I give them basically is a video of the road. So that's the sort of tie. And then I give them the timing. But beyond that, how they respond to it is however they want to. They can respond to the history if they do a little bit of research into it, or they could respond to the actual physical twists and turns and the visual of the road. So there's so much there. And again, it kind of goes back to this idea that this car screen is almost ridiculously waiting for something to be applied upon it that doesn't distract you from what you have to do, but actually allows you to sort of think and maybe feel more present where you are. I've been working with a really, really extraordinary and talented sound editor called Tygo Sullivan. And he actually came to me about a year ago and he had read a sort of tiny little blurb on my website about this project. And he simply said he was interested in sound and place. And we met up and discussed this and then went together to do this ambient field recording. And it was him who then put it all together and worked the field recordings that he recorded on site on the road actually into the music itself. So there's this extraordinary experience when you're driving where you're listening to the music and you feel sort of immersed in it, and then suddenly sounds from outside come into your car, and again it kind of holds you down more into where you are.
Shall we have a little listen to some of that? This is from track 2, which is a combination of these field recordings and then also the composition of Brendan William Jenkinson.
Yeah.
So I think it's really incredible there, the use of field recordings, the way you can just picture something, can't you? And it's really bringing that sense of being outside, I guess.
Yeah, there's a phrase actually that I read just before publishing the poster that really summed up what I wanted to kind of say about it, which is by this Lebanese author called Yalal Tufik. And he says, inducing of the uncanny should not be limited to TV or radio, but should be done in real life. And I think that really sort of captured this idea that you can enhance the sort of subjective experience of a place with these really subtle cues. So I went on my most recent drive up there listening to this score, and it was a really different day than I'd experienced before. I was driving and it was really, really misty, and I was listening to that piece of music, and this deer ran in front of the car at a certain moment, and it just made this sort of coincidental feeling happen. And I think it's like a sort of certain way of reading the world in a way. It's quite magical. So I'm really excited by people's sort of different readings of it each time they listen.
It's really interesting. Should we have a listen to another extract?
This is the third track on the piece, and it's by an Irish fiddle player called Cuivín O'Rahilig. And actually his interpretation of the project was really interesting as well, because Cuivín would be really, really well known as a traditional musician and composer in Ireland. He plays fiddle and he also plays the hardanger, which is sort of Scandinavian, very resonant fiddle. But for this project, he went with a totally different style, which was really exciting and sort of rewarding to get the chance to hear.
Really beautiful and kind of calming, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
How did the different composers come up with the scores? Did they interact with the landscape much?
It's been really, really different. Like, for example, Cuivín's family actually live sort of at the beginning of the road, so he would have gone a lot on his own trips up there. Whereas Cian Nugent, who is, I guess he's a little bit younger as well, so he doesn't drive himself, but he and I went on loads of little trips up there long before the project was sort of consolidated in a sense. So I suppose there was a mixture of people who were kind of actually sitting there in the site listening to it and then also just reading a bit about it. I'm quite looking forward to working with, I suppose, less beautiful sites. Like, it was always my intention to work with motorways, and it was always my intention to sort of play with that idea of how a motorway cuts through and almost makes anonymous a landscape. So I like the idea of playing with maybe that sort of aggression of infrastructure in a way as well. And there's a huge amount of stories that come at roads. I actually did a research project in Brown University in 2010 all about a section, just one little section of the I-95 highway, which had displaced an entire community in the 50s and was now being changed and was displacing and changing this sort of societal structure again. So I think there's really vast amounts of research that you can look into in roads, and they're sort of an in-between space that we don't really look at, we don't really consider our journey on. So that's a really exciting part of it for me.
And let's talk a bit about plans for the future. So you're developing an app at the moment to go with the soundscapes.
Yeah, so it's always been in my mind to create a network, essentially, of these scores. This is the first one. And what I want to do next is to create a platform that's really easily accessible to people, where you can access more of them and also where I can easily upload more of them. So to set it in motion now that the first one's been made, that more and more can be made for certain sites, in future, as I learn and work a bit more with developers, I'm interested in actually developing a technology that suits it more specifically.
And that was Fiona Hallinan with her music. Speaking to Monocle's Katie Bilboa for this week's edition of Culture, which you can catch at 1900 London time tonight here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this to look at the story of Van Gogh's sunflower paintings with author Martin Bailey.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week, Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and ask the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
Who governs the city, who owns the city, who has the right to decide what happens in the city?
The bridge becomes an instrument not of moving traffic, but of land development.
There needs to be a voice for the people that says, okay, now we need a library, now we need the green park. These things that are greater than the individual interests.
Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House. The time now is 8:41 here in London.
Now, Georgina, can we call a work of art that isn't an icon, that's a religious icon, iconic?
I think we can, but we do need to know how to pronounce the name of the artist correctly.
We do indeed. We'll get to that in a minute. But I just want to debate, what would be on that list of iconic artworks, would you say?
Well, the Mona Lisa.
I was thinking of maybe Guernica.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, yeah, definitely. And, of course, sunflowers.
Absolutely. Definitely one which should be on that list would be Sunflowers by the great Dutch artist with the unpronounceable surname. But I'll call him Vincent van Gogh for the moment, because that's what I've always gone for, and I'll be proved wrong in a minute. But this was famously one of the most valuable paintings in the world. One of his sunflower paintings sold for just under $40 million back in 1987.
Well, as you said, that was just one of a series of sunflower paintings by which he made over a two-year period in the late 1880s. And not all of them still exist. Six sunflowers were destroyed by fire in the 1940s. But now a version of one of them has been tracked down, along with the painting's original frame. And the whole story is set out in a new book, The Sunflowers Are Mine.
And joining us now in the studio is the author of that book, Martin Bailey. Greetings, Martin.
Hello.
Now, for starters, let's just get this out of the way. Correct pronunciation of the great master's name, please.
Well, it's in Dutch, it's pronounced Van Gogh, which is very difficult for the British to say.
It is, isn't it?
Yes, and that's why he wanted to be called Vincent, because he said foreigners murdered his name and couldn't pronounce it correctly. And we all pronounce it wrongly. The English, of course, say Van Gogh. The Americans say Van Gogh. And the French say Van Gogh.
So there we have it. Now, this book of yours, it concerns all the sunflower paintings, but we said in our introduction one particular note of interest was Six Sunflowers, which is one which was previously considered lost.
Yes, I mean, it was destroyed during American bombing of Japan in 1945. It was in a Japanese collection from about 1920. And what I discovered was a very early colour reproduction from 1921, which showed the painting in its true vibrant colours with a royal blue background. But most exciting was the fact that in the reproduction there was an orange frame around the painting. And I then went back to Van Gogh's letters, and he actually describes in one of the letters how he was going to paint an orange frame around the blue background of the sunflowers. So for the first time, we can see the artwork as originally created of Van Gogh, and Van Gogh felt the frame was an integral piece of the work of art.
Tell us the story of your discovery, because that was a very interesting journey.
Yes, I mean, it was fascinating working on the book, The Sunflowers Are Mine. You might expect such a subject to be so well researched that there was nothing more to discover, but I found quite a lot more. And the first half of the book deals with Van Gogh's lifetime and him painting sunflowers, particularly the ones in Arles. And then the second half deals with what happened to the sunflower paintings after he died, and that had not been well researched at all. So there was a lot of discoveries there.
Mm. You know, we were talking about this reproduction of Six for Sunflowers, the original painting being destroyed. I mean, it's the textures in Van Gogh paintings that really appeal to people. So how much does one get from a reproduction, even if it is in the original frame?
It is much better going to see the original thing. I mean, for example, the National Gallery Sunflowers in London, the famous one we all know with the yellow background. I mean, it's a strong image in reproduction. But when you actually go and see the painting face to face, you then see the impasto, the raised paint and the slight sort of shadows to it. And it has an almost three-dimensional quality. So it's always worth seeing the real thing.
That 15 sunflowers, the one that's in the National Gallery here in London, has had an amazing history, and it was worked on by a German art historian, I think just outside Glasgow, wasn't it? But with a cheese grater and a domestic iron.
This was during the Second World War. I mean, it was quietly evacuated from the Tate, where it was then, to a castle in the Lake District, which was very remote. And then it was decided the painting needed conservation. And the conservator who was working on the Tate's pictures was at that point living in a farmhouse in Scotland, in a remote area. And he borrowed the sunflowers. He took it to his farmhouse and he said that he hung it above the sofa in his sitting room, and it brightened up his wartime exile. But the most astonishing thing was the primitive equipment that they had during the war. And as you said, he used a cheese grater to make the wax particles for the back of the canvas. He then used a domestic iron to heat the back of the canvas to melt the wax. And he finally used the dentist burnishing instrument to put down a paint which was lifting slightly. I mean, this would horrify conservators totally. Today. But fortunately, the painting actually survives in very good condition.
One of the things which struck both Georgina and I as an enormous irony about the Six Sunflowers painting, which was destroyed, you've discovered the original frame with this good quality print, but if the owner had kept it in that frame in the first place, it might not have been destroyed.
Well, it was, yes. I mean, he put it in a very ornate gilt frame, which was very heavy. And in fact, a few years earlier, it had actually fallen on the floor when it had been exhibited for a few days in a Japanese shop. And it was so heavy, this frame, he never lent it again, and he kept it above his sofa too. And then, of course, when the fire started because of the American bombing, it was impossible to move, so it was because it was so heavy, so it was very sadly lost. Mm.
I just want to turn to Van Gogh's life for a moment, because in the course of your research and your writings, you've dug up a newspaper article which describes the whole cutting off the ear incident. And it's actually surprisingly prominent, and you'd think for really a little known man in a remote area, his brother was quite well known, but why was there so much prominence given to what really would have been quite a small incident?
Yes, it was astonishing. I mean, I found the first newspaper report of when he mutilated his ear, which appeared 2 days afterwards in a Paris newspaper. And it was actually, and this newspaper article had never been spotted before. And it was astonishing. It was the first item of provincial news in this newspaper. And it really shows that for some reason, this sort of grabbed people's attention at the time. Of course, it does now, but it's difficult to imagine that something 600 kilometres away from Paris, an incident like this would have caused this sort of attention. And of course, this is what we have now. There's enormous interest in Van Gogh, both as an artist and a human being. And lots of people are so interested in his life and work.
Something which strikes me as very curious, I mean, your book, The Sunflowers Are Mine, it's about still life. And is there any other artist that has achieved such fame for a series of still lives. When we think of the other iconic paintings we were bandying about beforehand, none of them were sets of flowers.
No, it is astonishing. And it's difficult to explain quite why it grabs people. I mean, one of the things that I like about it is the flowers are at different stages, and some of them are little buds coming out, some of them are in full bloom, and some are turning to seed. So it's like the story of a human family, if you like. And the other thing that Van Gogh is so marvellous about is this use of colour, the yellow background with the yellow sunflowers in front of it, and the yellow and the blue. He has, in a way, made the still life, as you say. It's something which other artists haven't managed to do with the same success and impact.
Very, very interesting. Martin, thank you so much for coming on to speak to us. Now, the book is called The Sunflowers Are Mine, and of course it's at all good bookshops right now.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Liam Liddell. Hello. Welcome back to the Drawing House.
Oh, hello, guy.
You just caught me in the midst of talking to producer Alad there about what's coming up next, which it'll be the Turkish front pages. But first, we're going to have a bit of non-Turkish music. Jamie Liddell with Another Day.
Another day, another way for me to open up to you.
Jamie Liddell and what sounded like the Ronnie Hazelhurst Memorial Orchestra there.
Thank you very much for that, Guy. I can tell that you're an enormous fan.
I don't know. I like bits of Jamie Liddell, but just not the Ronnie Hazelhurst bits.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Georgina Godwin, and Jamie Liddell fan Guy Delaunay. Now, the producer of the latest edition to our Monocle 24 lineup, Aperitivo, joins us in the studio. Daniel Jacopelli tells
Hello.
Us. Hi, and you've got this great new programme. It's starting tonight.
Tonight is the premiere. Yes. Are you excited, both of you?
I'm very excited. You're going to tell us all the Turkish news, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I'm here to talk Turkish news and the new addition to our lineup, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so it premieres tonight, 1800 hours London time. The idea behind this show is we're kind of drawing out things a bit more. We're going to have more space for discussion, analysis.
Cocktails,
flat whites.
Flat whites?
Maybe.
At that time of day?
Yeah.
Is that wise?
Am I committing some kind of like coffee taboo?
Yes, absolutely.
That's not like doing
Aperol
a cappuccino.
Spritz time.
Shouldn't have any. Yeah, absolutely, quite right. Yeah. Aperol spritz. Absolutely, totally agree with you.
Well, we do have some good Aperol spritz at the cafe.
Uh huh.
Well, so today actually is the premiere. As I said, we're going to have George Brock, who's the head of journalism at City University, and Gregory Beichmann, who's the head of media at Reuters, and. First half hour is kind of a lengthy discussion about the top news of the day. We're going to look back the two, three big stories of the day, tease them out a bit. We might hear from some of our correspondents. It's going to be a kind of more casual yet still newsy show.
And who's presenting?
Tonight is Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor.
Fantastic. So he'll be really able to get in-depth into those big international stories.
Yeah, and also it's different with this show as we were live at some points in the cafe, the Monocle Cafe, which is just a hop around the corner here from Midori House. So today we're actually going to be speaking with the head of 100% Design, which is a gigantic design show that's starting here in London this week. So he'll be live in the cafe with our editor, Andrew Tuck. And we'll have a few other surprises too. We're going to have a report from our San Francisco correspondent at the America's Cup sailing competition out there. And we have a really packed week, actually. So
now, in America's Cup is a huge deal, isn't it? I hadn't realized quite what a big thing
gigantic.
It is.
It's kind of it's like the Formula One of sailing. I mean, it's huge amounts of money. Larry Ellison, who's the head of Oracle, he throws all of his money into the American team, and still, actually, they almost they almost lost a bit to the Kiwis.
I was going to say we had our check-in from Auckland earlier on, and
we didn't get round to asking them, did we?
And we didn't, sadly. But
they're very proud about their team.
But they are very, very happy about that.
Yeah.
That they've done so, because they haven't done well for a number of years, and
right.
I think that they're very pleased about that.
And there's a lot of complications too to the city, the host city. Larry Ellison chose San Francisco as the host city, and it doesn't seem like they've really gotten enough. All the money that they thought they would get in from this event. So Alistair kind of reports on the city too. He goes to town hall.
And they've also got these very controversial catamarans, which are quite unstable in certain circumstances.
Sure, we saw that accident a couple months, I think it was a couple months ago, in which a sailor died. It's not the most safe sport, but it's like Formula One. Every once in a while you have an accident, but super high tech, lots of money, lots of fun. And we'll be there tonight.
Well, I've been on a yacht once and never again because I fell down the hatch.
Oh, no.
So that was it for me.
I think you won't make the cut for the Zimbabwean team.
Danny, tell us, how often will Aperitivo be on? Is this a weekly program?
It's a daily show. It's a daily show. So actually, we booked out the whole week. We're going to be speaking to the director of Somerset House off the back of London Fashion Week. We're going to pop over to the Atlas Gallery, which is a great gallery right around the corner from Adore House. The chairman of London Design Festival is going to be here. And we'll have a few other reports from our correspondents. So it is a daily show. It will be the best show in our lineup. Not because I'm producing it, but because it's pretty good, I have to say.
Aled, are you hearing this?
So, and the presenters of Midori House, thank you for
as
that.
As he puts up the music and he kicks me out of the show.
Yeah, off you go, Danny.
Okay.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Georgina Godwin and Guy Delaunay. Thank you so much for joining us. That's about all we've got time for. Thanks to our producers, Aled John, and to Barbara Feeney, our researchers, Fernanda Augusta Pacheca and Matt Alagaya. Also to our studio manager, Alex Funnell.
Up next, after the news, is The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Myself and Chloe Potter will be back with Midori House, the best programme on Monocle 24, at the same time tomorrow. Until then, from me, Guy Delaunay.
And me, Georgina Godwin.
Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.